Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Dutch journalist and author Rutger Bregman. I think his name should perhaps be more pronounced in something more like Rutger Bregman, but I'll stick to the easiest pronounced version. That means talking about two of his books, Humankind, A Hopeful History, and Utopia for Realists. Bregman isn't a socialist. I don't think it would take it all that much to make him one, but he does have some things to say which are interesting to both socialists and non-socialists. And as you can see from the list of links and so on, he's already received a fair amount of attention in the Socialist Standard. So I'll talk about each book in turn, summarise what it says, add a few comments of my own, and then throw the thing open to discussion. So we'll begin then with Humankind, A Hopeful History. The title of the original Dutch version of this translates to something like most people behave sensibly or behave reasonably. And that's a good summary of what the book is basically saying, that people are on the whole not lazy or selfish or aggressive or violent, but they behave in a reasonable kind of way. So in a sense, although Bregman doesn't actually put it in these terms, the book is a kind of argument against the human nature dismissal of socialism as being impractical because human beings aren't good enough or nice enough to live in a socialist society. Bregman looks at various case studies, and I can't look at them all here, so I'll just describe some of them. We'll start with William Golding's novel Lord of the Flies, which is quite popular and was made into a film. And I studied it at school a few years ago, for instance. What happens in the novel is that a group of boys are shipwrecked on an island, and the result is violence, authority, death. It's a really rather nasty picture of what might happen in a society where there's no sort of central authority or whatever. Now, it is a novel, and it's not based on real events. It's not a novelization of what really happened. But after a great deal of work, Bregman does track down a real case, which was essentially the same sort of setting as Lord. A group of six boys were marooned on a Pacific island for over a year. But what happened was completely different from what happens in Golding's book. They worked together, they grew food. One of them, for example, broke their leg, and the other boys got together to mend it and so on. Things didn't always go well, of course, but if there was arguments, someone would go off to the other end of the island, and eventually things would calm down and so on. So the real case of something Lord of the Flies like was actually very different from what happened in the book. And I'll just read you a quick thing that Bregman says. The real Lord of the Flies is a story of friendship and loyalty, a story that illustrates how much stronger we are if we can lean on each other. Of course, it's only one story, but if we're going to make Lord of the Flies required reading for millions of teenagers, then let's also tell them about the time real kids found themselves stranded on a deserted island. And he also says, one in the book, quote, catastrophes bring out the best in people. And that's specifically about Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. And, of course, there are similar examples. People talk about the Blitz spirit in London during the Second World War, for instance. So the Lord of the Flies example is just one case study where what really happened in real life, as it were, was very different from the very pessimistic approach taken in the book. Let's go on to another example. In 1964, a woman called Kitty Genovese was murdered in New York. And supposedly what happened was that lots of people saw the attack, but they didn't do anything. They didn't attempt to stop it or tell the police or anything like that. Supposedly because they were indifferent and didn't care what was happening. And what took place there is sometimes called the bystander effect. People watch something nasty happening, but they don't do anything about it. They just stand and watch your Let me take a sip. People see something nasty happening, they just don't do anything, they just watch or they go on their way and mind their own business. However, again, once Bregman starts looking at what really happened, it was completely different from the picture that is often painted. People did report it, but the police didn't arrive, and that was one of the reasons why Genovese was killed. The part of the point here is that the media completely misreported what happened, and that's because they like exceptional stories. So a news story, woman attacked in street, people come and help her, contact the police, that's not news. Woman attacked in street, people ignore what's going on, that is news, unfortunately. So the media tend to misreport that kind of situation. Moving on to my third example, these are not so much what sort of happened in real life, but some psychological experiments that were carried out under the aegis of a man called Stanley Milgram in the early 60s. Without going into too much detail about it, in an experimental situation, people were put in a position where it appeared that they were inflicting pain on other people in the experiment, and supposedly people were quite happy to carry on doing this, to upping the electric shock that people were being subjected to. They weren't, in fact, but that's the way it was made to appear to them. So the sort of image of this is that people were quite happy to inflict pain on other people. However, again, the reality is very different from the normal picture of it. Firstly, many people realised that they weren't really inflicting pain on the other subjects in the experiment. And also, most of those taking part stopped participating because they either thought it was real and therefore weren't prepared to inflict pain, or they realised that the whole thing was a con trick. So people then, and what another thing that this experiment shows, is that people have to be coerced into doing bad things, whether it's by someone in a lab coat or someone saying, you've got to do this, otherwise the experiment won't work. So again, the idea that this experiment shows that people are quite happy to inflict pain on others, it doesn't show that at all. And my last, although less specific, case study I'm going to look at is what happens in wars. In wars, most soldiers don't kill anyone. In fact, they don't even fire their weapons. They aim their guns over above the heads of the enemy and so on. And, most people who are killed in war are killed remotely. Artillery, bombs, I suppose, and drones nowadays. So it's not a matter of firing at people. It's a matter of not doing that when it's some matter of sort of personal contact, as it were. And he talks about that fairly well-known example of the Christmas truce in the First World War, which was often extended longer than simply Christmas Day and so on. So wars, again, are not a simple example of people prepared to kill or like killing or prepared to kill just at the sort of without really being forced to do it. So there were, and I said, there are a number of other examples which I haven't got time to look at, where Bregman looks at supposed examples of people behaving in an unpleasant or cruel or aggressive kind of way. And most of them aren't really what the standard establishment picture of what happened implies. But of course, then we have to look at the answer, why do people, the question, why do people fight? Why do they argue? Why do people sometimes act in an aggressive or utterly selfish kind of way? And there are various answers to this. In war, for example, soldiers fight because of solidarity with other soldiers, not so much for queen and country, but for the other people in their platoon or whatever. Soldiers also have to be conditioned to kill and be nasty and so on. And if people become a bit more powerful, then that can go to people's heads and make them more likely to act in a cruel or aggressive or unfriendly kind of way. Bregman argues that empathy is not really a good thing because it's rather similar to xenophobia, dislike of foreigners and so on. What is more important is compassion. It's compassion that will stop people behaving in a nasty, negative way rather than empathy and so on. I must say, I found Bregman's arguments here a bit less convincing than some of the other things he says in the book. And there are other views, and there have been articles about this in recent issues of The Standard that you can talk about in the discussion session later on. And for example, recent reference in The Standard to dehumanisation. That's to say, people are more likely to act in a nasty way towards others if they regard them as being less than fully human. That's not a concept which comes from Bregman, it's taken from elsewhere, but I guess that is one possible reason why people do behave badly sometimes. Clearly, it's not enough just to say people are basically okay. You have to accept that sometimes people do behave in a not okay way. But you've got to remember that all this nastiness is in the context of a society which is based on conflict and people being nasty to each other and competing with each other and so on. So Humankind, The Hopeful History, then, says interesting things which you don't normally find, say, in many people who claim at least to question the status quo. Let's move on then to Bregman's other book, although in fact it's the one that was written first, Utopia for Realists, and How We Can Get There, I think is the subtitle. Utopia for Realists contains some good criticisms of capitalism, but I don't think it really goes far enough in terms of how to address what those problems are. Of course, that's quite a common situation with people who have begun to see through the present system. Bregman notes to begin with that there have been vast improvements in human well-being over recent decades and centuries. So, for example, far fewer children die either in childbirth or when young than happened 200 or 300 years ago and so on. Far fewer people die from malnutrition than used to. Life expectancy has gone up in most parts of the world in quite substantial ways. So there's lots to talk about from a kind of positive point of view. But at the same time, there has been an increase in anxiety and depression, increases in problems with mental health and so on. I have to wonder a bit whether that's a real increase or just that people become more aware of these issues and so on. But also people working harder, particularly if you think that when there was just a male breadwinner in a family who would work for whatever many hours, but now men and women, if you add the hours that male and female partners both work, then that's probably more hours than was the case previously. And what Bregman claims to offer is not a solution, but more sort of guideposts, or as Hugo puts it, alternative horizons to different forms of utopia. I think perhaps we should try to leave aside for the moment any negative ideas which this word utopia has and just look at these in terms of an improved way of running society. So in terms of jobs, Graeber notes, for instance, that a great with many jobs under present-day capitalism, they don't create wealth, they just move it around or do other pointless things. So he refers, I think, to David Graeber's work on bullshit jobs, which are precisely that, that don't do anything worthwhile in terms of creating wealth or doing useful or providing useful services or anything like that. Many jobs have already been taken over by machines, and there's at least the possibility of shorter working hours. I know some companies are supposedly going over to a four-day week. I don't know what the chances of that really happening under capitalism are. And he talks also, Bregman, about the possibility of eradicating poverty. And he claims that in the United States, the cost of eradicating poverty would be about a quarter of what is spent every year on military, on the armed forces. So a quarter of military spending could, he claims, eradicate poverty in the United States. So, for example, more generally, the best way to cure homelessness is free housing. Give housing to people for nothing, and that will provide homes, and they will, you know, look after the homes and so on. Apparently, in 2009, there was an experiment took place in London. Homeless people were given £3,000 each. And they didn't just go and spend it all straight away. They only spent part of what they'd been given. And one advantage of this policy was that it cut the amount of money spent on homelessness strategies and so on. So giving people money like this, they do in fact behave in a responsible and sensible way. And it saves the government or whoever with money in terms of what is spent overall. And this, of course, brings us on to universal basic income, UBI, where the government pays a regular monthly income to everybody, which has become quite a popular idea in some circles, at least. And he claims, for instance, that there have been experiments in this in the States. So sometime in Utah, free housing was provided to people, and that reduced chronic homelessness, for instance. Richard Nixon, he tried to pass a law which was sort of similar to universal basic income, but he couldn't get it through the House of Congress or whatever. Yeah. So it's not something which is completely radically left-wing. Certainly Nixon wasn't, obviously. Okay, if I now move on now briefly, not from the book, but to the article by Bregman on UBI on the World Economic Forum website, which is there in the list of contacts and of the list of links and so on. Clearly, the objection to UBI is that it would mean a big increase in taxes. And what he proposes in this World Economic Forum article is a slightly changed version of it. What he calls a basic income guarantee, a negative income tax. That's to say, the basic income would not be provided to absolutely everybody, since some people, capitalists and some workers, are so well off that they wouldn't need the universal basic payout. Instead, you would have a negative income tax. And if you earn below the poverty line, then the government would pay you. So the idea is that the payout wouldn't go to everybody. It would only go to those who were below the poverty line, which I guess would have to be clearly have to be fixed in a fairly standard kind of way. So working would still pay off. If you earned above the poverty line, you would still, you know, get paid and so on. And he claims that the net expense is the same as what universal basic income would cost. And again, he claims that this program in the States would eliminate poverty, and it would cost less than child poverty does at the moment, because things like healthcare and crime are expensive, and they are expensive consequences of child poverty, whereas this negative income tax would supposedly cost less and would eliminate poverty, he claims. And rather than talk about universal basic income or negative income tax, instead he proposes the term basic security for this idea. I'm not quite sure what difference that makes. That's what he says. And as far as I can see, that would still be very expensive. And as was pointed out in the review of Utopia for Realists in the Standard, the book should really be called Utopia for Utopians, because UBI really is a utopian measure. Would only work at very small levels, because the tax on profits that would be needed would be so large that it would really cost capitalism so much. And Bregman talks about, it's utopian, okay, but earlier utopian ideas have worked out. So, for example, votes for women. That was dismissed as absolute nonsense at one time, but of course it's now applies almost everywhere. But the difference, of course, is that votes for women doesn't go against the basics of capitalism, just as changing the laws on homosexuality doesn't go against the basics of capitalism, whereas UBI or negative income tax or basic security does go rather against the basics of capitalism. And unfortunately, Bregman does think that some kind of inequality should remain. So when I said earlier on that it wouldn't take much to make him a socialist, well, it would take a bit, because I'll just read you a short extract from Utopia for Realists. He says, society can't function without some degree of inequality. There still need to be incentives to work, to endeavour and to excel, and money is a very effective stimulus. Nobody would want to live in a society where cobblers earn as much as doctors, or rather, nobody living in such a place would want to risk getting sick. So in his utopia, there would still be wages, there would still be inequality, and so on, unfortunately. To conclude then, these are two very interesting books, well worth reading. You can start, if you like, if you're not familiar with them, by reading some of the stuff from the set of links there and see what was said in the Standard on this and related topics. And they do make points which are not usually found from people who question parts of the present system and who present themselves as critics of the status quo. So he goes rather further than most mild milk and water reformists would go. In the end, though, it's not realistic or radical, or if you like, utopian enough. Even though humankind makes a very strong argument that the kind of cooperation-based, egalitarian, socialist society without rulers and so on is entirely possible within human nature, unfortunately, Bregman doesn't quite go far enough, but he goes a pretty long way. And I think it's certainly encouraging that works like this are getting published and are getting discussed pretty widely within capitalism now. Okay, thank you. That's the end.